your generosity. Each year, for a week, we host Fund Drive, our annual fundraising campaign that augments our budget and supports our operations. It is thanks to you that we can rise higher and reach further.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and today I'm joined by Hale. When philosophers talk about simple, or they use the word simple, they're usually using it in, just to preface our discussion for today, because I think what we'll be talking about does touch on this dichotomy between what philosophers like to call simples and complexes. But as you alluded to, we want to talk about a bit more of an intuitive way of talking about simples, sometimes what people will call holes or gestalts even that is being too technical. I think we're being too technical if we give it a term, where we want to talk about the almost the mundane experiences, the things that we encounter in a sort of unanalyzed or just intuitive way. But in any case, I do want to flag up this distinction, because as a philosophy show, I feel a bit obligated to reference this kind of dual concept of simples and complexes. So just to remind listeners what exactly that is, a simple is something that doesn't have parts, right? It's unanalyzable. It just is what it is. Complexes are made up of parts. Theoretically, they're made up of simples too. They can be made up of other complexes. So the human body is made up of lots of complex things. But if you go down to whatever God particle there is, that would theoretically be simple. We're not doing quantum physics or anything like that. But we are talking about when in our life we experience things that are, when you think about it, complex, sure, like a car has wheels and a body and an engine and stuff like that. But we've certainly had experiences with cars where you step out in front of it and you see it, and it dawns on you as a single whole, as a simple thing.
Well, you know, I think, as you say, one of the ways that I try and think about it, or I try to elucidate to myself what we're going to be talking about today, there's the ways we interact with stuff. There's like our modes of being. You know, Hubert Dreyfus, someone we talked about previously, but a quite a well-known phenomenologist, philosopher and scholar. I believe he was based out of Berkeley for a long time. He died not that long ago, a couple of years ago, but big name in the kind of philosophy world for a long time. And, you know, and he kind of talked about this stuff a little bit using the phrase, I remember reading a paper or two, this was a little while ago, so if there's any big Dreyfus people listening, please don't skewer me for being too, you know, for taking it too simply. But, you know, this kind of idea that there's background practices that we're kind of like, there's a way in which all of us just kind of operate in the world, you know? Like, I know in some more kind of psychology, like psychological circles and that kind of stuff, that people have been talking a lot lately about the sort of flow state. And like, that's a kind of a specific thing, but it's more like the idea that, like, you know, when I go out in the world and I operate and I interact with stuff, like the example of a car, you know, if someone asks me what a car is, well, suddenly, you know, we start breaking apart a definition and we start thinking about it in very particular ways. And it kind of, analysis, things begin to not be inaccurate, but look very different from what it is when I'm just like, I know the car because I get in the car and I drive the car and I see the cars and I avoid the cars and I think about like how that car is looking or that car is beat up or whatever. And there's this initial sort of presence or presencing of any sort of entity that often we interact with in a way that's completely different than when we analyze stuff. And it's a very hard thing to like grasp.
Yeah, it is very difficult to grasp. I mean, one of the other ways that you can think of this, maybe sticking with the car is even appropriate, is that it seems like when I think about relationships, it's the analysis of a thing doesn't factor into the relationships that we have with a given thing, because you have a relationship with something. So say your car starts having problems, right? In a strange intuitive way, you start kind of like stressing out. You start worrying about the car, like, oh no, what's wrong? Sometimes you do analysis to break it apart and figure out what's wrong, but the thing that you have an issue with, or the experiences with the car, even though you do have this, I think philosophers would be tempted to call it like a higher relationship with the parts. It's more cognitive. It's more analytic. At the same time, there's this almost parallel process going on where you're doing all of this analysis because you need to fix your car. You don't need to fix the wheels of the car. You don't need to fix, you know, the spark plugs are broken. Those are not what you care about. You're replacing the spark plugs because you need to fix your car. So you can have experiences with holes in this way that you don't, it doesn't seem like you can with parts of things.
Well, it's almost kind of like ironic, use a continuum on with the car thing where, or the car example, where, you know, we like you were kind of elucidating, we have this tendency, and I think this is part of what we want to get into. We have this tendency in philosophy, along with all just thinking in general, that like the higher order thinking, the better thinking, the more complicated thinking is the analysis, right? Like that's where like the smart people stuff happens. But you know, the car example is good. The broken car example is good for two reasons. One, because, you know, going back to a sort of like a very phenomenologist look at it, you know, the thing only reveals itself as something at like, it only starts to reveal itself in a new way when it doesn't work, right? And so it's like, I am with and operate with my car almost not actually unconsciously, but in a way we might think of unconsciously, until it stops working, until one day, you know, I turn the key, the car won't turn on, and the battery, you know, there's something wrong. And then suddenly, you know, the car as an entity, as a collection of parts, as this concept starts to like stare me in the face, and it's this thing, and it's impeding my way in life. It's no longer this smoothly operating entity that's just a part of my day to day. But the irony is that, like, okay, well, now you start to think more conceptually and analytically in the car. You start to break down its parts, all this kind of stuff, whatever it's going to be. But especially with something like a car, the irony is that you do that to get back to the place where you stop noticing it. You know, I was reading another, a totally different book called On Decline. You know, he made a differentiation between two types of thinking, of kind of mental order that we have. There's a first and second order. And first is the first kind of level of consciousness, for lack of a better way of saying it, is a kind of like emotive, the auto-responsive. It's not that you're actually unconscious, but you just, like where we're talking about, you have these practices, you have these abilities, and they operate in the background. And then the second higher level is this zone of analysis that people can do. I can take a step back from that process and go, okay, well, what's going on there? Here's the parts. Here's how this all fit together. Here's how we got here. I think this is where it's going. I can make predictions. I can become conceptual, right? And that second order is generally considered to be more the realm of rationality and more given this sort of like elevated, it's a special zone, it's the very human, it's the realm of reason. That might not always be the case, and maybe that privileging is, in the process of privileging that kind of highly rational conceptual thinking, you lose out on something that is far more human, and that's that kind of operating mode, those background practices, this, you know, the life of the simple. And there's a lot more there than we tend to give it credit for.
If it constitutes what we might call our life world, then it's almost all there is. Any kind of analysis is just derivations on holes that we really live into in a certain way. So it's interesting because despite the fact that we live sort of unconsciously, when we talk about these ways of living our lives, you know, phenomenologists and philosophers alike will use words like unconscious or automatic or pre-reflective or something like that. But at the same time, there is a way to think about and kind of mentally or even linguistically encounter the simple, right? And that is the domain of, say, like art or poetry or any kind of non-analytic gestalt sort, you know, that sort of domain of seeing holes and really knowing that you're looking at what you're looking at, you know. So again, let's go back to the car. A person who encounters their car can, I mean, what would a poem about a nice car look like? Any kind of mode of thinking that you'd have to go into to write metaphors for, you know, a steel chariot or, I don't know, some kind of partner and crime or something like that. You know, that's the mode of thought that you would have to enter into to be seeing the car as a whole. And yet you can still say something about it. I mean, we're tempted to say that there's something like inherently analytical about language because you have to pick out these words and then arrange them in sentences. And yet poets, authors, maybe some philosophers, they find a way to express what language kind of puts in the way.
You and I have both brought up some pieces of literature as examples of art that we can share over the radio, because, you know, there are fantastic examples, and you and I have talked previously about, you know, both of us encountering various, you know, imagery or whatever it might be, that we felt kind of elucidated this. But unfortunately for our listeners, it's kind of, we can't really show you a painting on the radio. Those mediums that don't, the message does not fit the media. But we both have brought a couple of very short pieces of literature and poetry, because, you know, to give our listeners a little bit of the behind the scenes, both of us obviously like to read quite a bit. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we read is going to be highly technical, not to make either of us sound like, you know, super duper smart, big brain type guy. But I mean, like, you know, whether it be a lot of philosophy books or even some types of literature, like there's certainly people who really focus in on being as highly accurate and conceptual and descriptive as possible, and really use, you know, that kind of like, okay, we're going to break everything down and analyze every aspect. And that's going to add a lot of complexity to the work that I'm doing. But the idea is, you know, that we don't want to miss anything. We don't want to miss the pieces. But then there's also a different type of, I find, literature that I, you know, and I'll share a piece in a moment, that is very simple. That, you know, and some people call this, you know, a more like a natural language style, a plain language style. And initially, people might think that that's kind of a cover for it being like dumb, unfortunately, which I don't think at all. But I think that on some level, especially within literature, at least, especially with poetry, there's something to a natural style, a simple style, a plainness, and especially oftentimes a plainness of topic as well, that touches on something that is much oftentimes bigger and more complete than more complex forms of literature and analysis can actually capture. It's harder to piece all that stuff together, right? Like, it's like trying to build something out of a whole bunch of tiny pieces versus having like one solid block.
They both are pointing at the same figure, but it's like kind of trying to square a circle, right? Like, analysis is additive, but if you're trying to make a circle, why don't you just have a circle, right?
So maybe I'll start off. It was a very short thing. This is from, so I started reading a book by Charles Bukowski, Hamlet and Rye. It's quite a famous, relatively famous novel. Charles Bukowski was kind of another kind of mid-20th century American writer, known for his simple, plain language, often, frankly, coarse style that really focused on the subject matter of everyday people or individuals living lives that may or may not be all that happy or successful or whatever, right? Very regular. And I really, it was really the opening of this book that really caught me, because I had never read anything before. And it caught me for its simplicity of capturing a moment that I felt intimately connected to, but I also felt was explained in a really simple way. So just, it's literally the beginning of this. This is the first paragraph, the first chapter. It's talking about his younger, his first memories, really. By the way, the novel is more or less loosely based around his experience as a young person. And so he said, "The first thing I remember is being under something. It was a table. I saw a table leg. I saw the legs of people and a portion of the tablecloth hanging down. It was dark under there. I liked being under there. It must have been in Germany. I must have been between 1 or 2 years old. It was 1922. It felt good under the table. Nobody seemed to know that I was there. There was sunlight upon the rug and on the legs of the people. I liked the sunlight. The legs of the people were not interesting. Not like the tablecloth that hung down. Not like the table leg. Not like the sunlight." So that's just that's the opening paragraph. As an aside, for simplicity's sake, I think the word with the most syllables in that paragraph is Germany with 3. Just scanning it, or interesting, maybe 4, maybe interesting with 4. But the point is that it's all simple language, as the sense of is all very simple, regular, everyday. The vernacular, like, is very much all chosen out of the everyday, clearly intentionally. And it's also focusing on a moment that is very personal and, frankly, forgettable for most of us. It is not, there is actually nothing super interesting going on there. I have memories, I think it resonated a bit with me because I have a very similar memory of being, my parents had a dining table that I remember being very young, I would hide under and play around under. It was a glass dining table, actually, so you could see through. So I remember being, like, kind of immersed in the glass. And you know how you can, like, if you have a sheet of glass and you look in the side of the glass, there's, like, something where it does that reflective prism thing. So I remember doing that kind of stuff. But again, very similar kind of cell memory. But again, really, there's something, at least to me, about that paragraph, about that work, that really captures the simplicity of a childhood experience extremely well and extremely simply, in a way that an analysis of how a child sees the world and interacts with the world would never be able to capture. Like, you could read, or we could go through some sort of textbook or workbook on, you know, on child psychology and child interactions and child experiences, or some sort of textbook or whatever on memory and adults reflecting upon memory in the past and this kind of stuff. And yet, all of that would fail to capture the simplicity of having that kind of moment of interest in a child and the reflection that one has in adulthood of those sorts of moments. And that is all done through this very simple paragraph. There's a lot, it's, and I think this is one of the points that we're going to get into. There's a lot going on there for not much being there.
Yeah. I mean, so the first thing that I like, the obvious thing about this, and this is like, I'm kind of just repeating your point, but not only is it a simple memory, it's simple language. And I feel like the tone and the atmosphere and the feeling, maybe we today, us moderns would say the vibe is, yeah, the vibe is conveyed by the language itself. It's kind of got this start and stop to it. It doesn't seem to want to pretend at all. I mean, I could easily, you know, when you think of people and they have these very early intimate moments that they remember, usually we can romanticize them or be nostalgic for them. It seems that Bukowski is he's attempting to be quite responsible to that early memory. He's not trying to cake it up with very much. He wants to report the facts as he saw them in that way. And by the fact that, because this is, it's striking and evocative, I think just because it's true, Bukowski is putting us in a context that actually existed. It's got a plausibility to it in that way. We, you know, we like, we like to talk about things like suspension of disbelief. I don't think that's what's going on here at all. I think this is a, because that'd be just so theoretical. Again, trying to go back to this simple articulation of a very simple, intimate moment. And we can feel that intimacy in it.
Yeah, and you know what the word that came to my mind as you were discussing that, that is frank. There's a certain frankness there that is really interesting. And again, you don't get, like, one thing analysis is not in general is frank. I can't think of a better word, but maybe that's because we're slipping into some plain everyday vernacular. But it's, you know, you start breaking down things into complexity and they lose that immediate sort of, like, the kind of like, yeah, I get it. Or as you're saying, like, here it is. Like, here's, like, this is the deal. It is what it is. Open and shut. The thing about this is an interesting paragraph because, and this is kind of interesting work that we're discussing, and I know you have some stuff as well, is because on the one hand, it's very simple, but there's a lot going on, and much like the divide that we experience through all of us sort of with our interactions, and you might call like the qualia of humanity, the subjective experience, is it's always like, I want to say there's a lot there to talk about, but kind of the point is that there also like isn't. Like, it is an excellent demonstration of a childhood memory reflection of something that's very personal and intimate to one person. What else do you like want to read into that?
Well,
right?
I think that's kind of one of the, that's an important part of what makes it a, well, you know, if we said effective, I don't think it would be, that's a very good word for it, because again, this doesn't seem to be like, it's like, here's a good question. What are our early memories for? I don't know. Like, I was just there and I had it and now I remember it and I cherish it or I have some feelings for it. I think I'll get into this when I start talking a bit later, is something about this that makes it do whatever it does is the fact that Bukowski just kind of like puts it there for you to look at. Like, it's not a premise in an argument. It's not really for anything. I mean, it's for something, you know.
Well, you know, but the for something that you're bringing up here, I think this is one of the most interesting aspects of maybe particularly like our modern conceptions of like articulation, is this kind of like teleological element and everything, where it's like, there has to be some, like, everything and every kind of thought and every sort of organization and every sort of analysis is all ultimately like going somewhere. They're all building blocks and pieces and arrows. And, you know, especially like in our current sort of societal makeup, there's this, like, you know, this emphasis on societal improvement or self-improvement, or like, there's always, progress is always moving in some direction and everything sort of fit together and has a reason for being there, and you have to figure it out what that reason is, and once you do, it's all the real meaning, and, you know, and then it all sort of points to something else and blah blah blah, all this kind of stuff. But again, like, as we've kind of discussed this whole time, we can just keep circling the drain. Like, that is not how any of us, well, at least I'm pretty sure, that's not actually how people interact in the world. Right? Like, that's not, and it's like Bukowski's kind of illustrating there. I mean, literally illustrating there, but like, sometimes you just have like experiences.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have memories.
Yeah. You know, like, sometimes you just see things.
Most of them are pretty plain and boring and not actually that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, most of the stuff nowadays is pretty plain and boring. But if you have people like Bukowski to not... See, this is the thing, too, is I don't even think Bukowski is, like, caking it up or putting any kind of makeup on it. And yet, it would be a thing at the moment where you just would have... You know, you find yourself somewhere, and then when you reflect on it later, it doesn't have any teleological sort of extension or meaning to it. But at the same time, there is something to cherish or appreciate putting this memory or this image or, you know, contemplating the meaning of it, something. The other thing I was going to say, too, is that it's not like I don't detect movement in this passage, right? Like, Bukowski is saying, what was the year? Was it 1922? Yeah, so he's saying Germany 1922. Like, that anticipates some things. But it's interesting because you can... It's almost like the memory in this passage has been... I don't want to say, like, that anticipation has been taken away or some way or something. He's kind of focalizing himself by deconnoting what that means. He's just putting the year in front of you. He's putting you what, you know, what country he's in. He's able to return you to that moment where, in hindsight, you'd be like, oh, like, some, you know, something's building. My childhood had some meaning. Maybe it did, and that's what gets developed later. But just this memory here, it lets you go back to being under that table and, you know, seeing legs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also had a poem.
Yeah, I had a poem about, I just wanted to bring it. Oh, yeah. I'll just go into the poem because I'm just trying to think if I want to do. Actually, you know what? I will talk just for a moment briefly about Betty Edwards, because I think that Betty Edwards here is, if we're touching on seeing things and not really ascribing like some kind of use value or like a teleology to them. So I have two things. I have Betty Edwards. She wrote probably the most famous and well-read and well-used drawing instruction book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Now, immediately when you suggested this kind of topic to me, I was like, well, I wanted to talk about Betty Edwards just a little, like, in some kind of philosophical context. And I feel like something like this is a good context to bring Edwards up in, because what Edwards says about learning to draw is that it's not actually about like hand-eye coordination or like knowing anatomy or anything like that. Like, those can help. But what really gets an artist or someone who is drawing, what allows them to really draw what's in front of them and really get the details right, is it's about seeing. You have to learn to see differently. So she uses some, like, it's not like outdated, but she uses this kind of she uses this old paradigm in psychology of left brain and right brain to talk about, which isn't like strictly false, but it's more complex than that. But it's a good metaphor for the fact that there's basically two ways of seeing and of thinking of things that we see. One she calls the right brain and the other the left brain. And the right brain is highly abstract. It's symbolic. It's abbreviative. It's analytic in that way. But the left brain is whole. It's dissociative or synthetic in a certain way. And it deals with perceptions and sort of intuitive, it's another way of seeing things, right? So I bring this up to say that one of the experiences that one has when you make this shift, and the book is full of exercises for making the shift. I won't try and one of them is to take the thing you're drawing and turn it upside down if you're drawing a picture of something, right? Because then it really lets you see, not, you break up that conceptual abstract understanding that would block you from really seeing what's in front of you, right? And you can start drawing the edge. You can start drawing, you know, if you're drawing, like, I like to draw cloth, so I can see the folds better. I can see where the shadows dip in with a certain crease or where a certain break in the fabric goes, right? You've broken up the concept of, oh, I'm just going to draw cloth. And then you just have like some stereotypical symbol for that in your mind. And you actually start seeing what's in front of you. And you can produce an enormous variety, because when you throw a cloth on a table or something, it falls however it falls. But I bring this up because one of the parallels is, or one of the things that happens when you enter this, she calls it R mode. I might have gotten them mixed up earlier, but in any case, when you enter this mode of being able to really see what's in front of you, you stop ask